Cientos años, Palestine 100 years by Diaspora Trio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Israel's bombardment of Gaza, I want to turn to the words of the British Palestinian surgeon, Hassan Abu Sita, describing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He'd been working in the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which was one of the last functioning hospitals in the Gaza Strip.
Yesterday, there was a major airstrike. Over 60 killed on a mosque. And Al-Ahli was completely inundated with wounded. And we were operating all through the night. And by the early hours of yesterday morning, we had realized that we have basically run out of medication for the anesthetic machines. And we had to stop the operating room. We had finished. And that's when we made the decision. At the same time, in the early hours of the morning, there was heavy bombing all around the hospital, and really close to the hospital. You could feel the whole building being shot. And we were being, and it sounded like tank fire. It didn't sound like air raids. And so we made the decision that it was time for at least the operating room staff, since they're not going to be able to provide a service, to evacuate. And so yesterday morning we left, and we could you could hear the sounds of the tanks around the hospital when we walked out. And we literally walked all the way to Nusayrat camp in the central zone. When we left, there were over 500 wounded needing urgent medical care, but needing surgical intervention that we could not provide because خلاص, I mean, we'd run out of medication. We'd run out of, the operating room could no longer function. And at the best, there were two operating rooms in it. We were always overwhelmed with the number of wounded compared with what we were able to provide.
The British Palestinian surgeon Hassan Abu Sita speaking through his surgical mask in Gaza. We've been trying to reach people there, but it's the second straight day of a telecommunications blackout. This is only the latest one. To talk more about Israel's bombardment of Gaza, we're joined now by independent journalist Sharifa Dokadus, produced the award-winning documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh for Al Jazeera's documentary series Fault Lines, and has reported from Gaza for Democracy Now! And other outlets. Sharif, it's so important to talk about what's happening there, even as this telecommunications blackout is happening. Also, the leaflets that are being dropped on Khan Yunis, which is where so many thousands of Palestinians have been instructed to go to head south from northern Gaza south. Now leaflets are being dropped there saying they must move further south. Can you respond to this overall situation?
Well, I mean, you have a situation where the northern part of Gaza, north of Wadi Gaza, and Gaza City itself, which was home to nearly 1 million people, is now a hollow shell. Most neighborhoods in Gaza City and in northern Gaza in general have been very badly damaged or destroyed. You have these armored columns of Israeli forces going in and tearing up the roads. Electricity, water, sewage infrastructure basically no longer exist. And, you know, there are reports that there's the smell of death is everywhere, as an untold number of bodies are lying under the rubble. The UN estimates that about 2,700 people, including 1,500 children, are missing and believed to be buried under the ruins. And there's reports of the people that have remained in the north digging with their bare hands, trying to find their family members. And the streets have been turned into graveyards. So only a fraction of the people who lived in northern Gaza remain there, and most have been forcibly displaced to the south. In scenes that are reminiscent of the Nakba, 1.5 million people have been displaced in Gaza. That's nearly double the number that were ethnically cleansed in 1948 and were never allowed to return to their homes. And many of these people are people who were displaced in, or their descendants from 1948. So we have to remember that 80% of Palestinians in Gaza are not from Gaza. They're refugees. So most of the Palestinians in northern Gaza are now packed into the south. There's no indication if or ever they'll be able to return to the north. The Israeli military effectively controls most of the northern area. And Gaza, northern Gaza, is basically uninhabitable now. You know, it's been destroyed. And there's hardly any aid coming in. You know, Gaza is now receiving only about 10% of its needed food supplies. Dehydration, malnutrition are growing. Nearly all of the people in Gaza, the 2.3 million people, are in need of food, according to the UN. And as you mentioned, the communication systems are down now for a second day. And this is a more serious telecommunications blackout because it's the result of no fuel to power the internet and phone networks. So it may be a more permanent communications blackout. And this communications blackout is actually causing disruptions to the little amount of cross-border aid deliveries that were coming in. And as you mentioned, the Israeli forces now have dropped these leaflets just the other day, telling Palestinians in areas east of Khan Yunis, which is a bigger city in the south of Gaza, to evacuate. Where are these people supposed to go? It increasingly seems that Israel's trying to push Palestinians into Egypt, which is a longstanding colonial fantasy. There are plans that have been documented for this, that there's a document leaked last month from Israel's intelligence minister that detailed, a durable post-war situation solution for Gaza, which includes the long-term transfer, forcible transfer of Palestinians to northern Sinai. There's something called the Island Plan, which is named after a retired major general who outlines a proposal to forcibly transfer Palestinians to Sinai. But right now, we don't know what the situation is. Egypt has staunchly refused this kind of mass displacement of Palestinians into its territory. And it has tried to negotiate aid to come in. But there's increasing pressure right now on Egypt because at the end of the day, this is an Egyptian border, the Rafah border crossing. It's the only border crossing into Gaza that is not controlled by Israel. Egypt right now is letting in maybe 50, maybe 80, maybe 100 trucks a day, just a fraction of the amount of aid that used to come into Gaza even before October 7th. And the reason it's only letting in a fraction is that it's allowing Israel to dictate the terms. So it gets approval from Israel of how many trucks can enter the Rafah border crossing. Those trucks then enter, they go up to an Israeli border crossing where they're checked, they come back down and then enter into Gaza. And there's increasing pressure on Egypt from civil society in Egypt, from people around the world, for Egypt to just open the border and let the aid in. If Israel wants to bomb UN aid trucks, then, that's something else. But right now, Egypt is coordinating with Israel on how much aid gets in, and people are beginning to starve, and infectious disease is spreading because of no water, and it's an incredible crisis.
Sharif, the number of journalists who've been killed. I think Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 42 journalists and media workers have been killed since October 7th. It's the deadliest month for journalists since the group began collecting information in 1992. If you can talk about the global response, the global journalist response, and then we'll talk a bit about the latest on Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed not in Gaza by the Israeli forces, but was killed last year outside the Jenin refugee camp.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say? I don't know what the number is even now. It's at least 35, maybe 40 Palestinian journalists have been killed in just over a month. By far the highest number of journalists killed in such a short amount of time. Foreign journalists can't get into Gaza. Israel's not letting them in, and nor is Egypt. So you have a situation where you're killing most of the journalists, the registered journalists in Gaza. You're not letting other journalists in. And then we've seen very problematic coverage from newsrooms, Western newsrooms, of what's happening on the ground, problematic language, and people have been protesting this. And we just saw, people have been resigning from the New York Times. The poetry editor of the New York Times just resigned from there, because of the language used by the New York Times in this coverage. But also, you haven't seen the type of outcry that one would imagine from the journalistic community for their colleagues who are being killed in Gaza. And the ones that aren't killed in Gaza have lost so much. They've lost their families. They've lost their homes. When Jamal Khashoggi was brutally murdered by the Saudi government, there was massive condemnation from Western news outlets for the murder, and rightly so. When Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who remains in prison in Russia, was arrested, there has been and still remains a massive outcry over his arrest. But we haven't seen the same kind of outcry over this record number of journalists, that Palestinian journalists that have been killed in Gaza. I think it's deeply, deeply problematic and reveals a bias that is being laid bare in many ways. And as you mentioned, Shireen Abu Akleh, when this all kind of the assault on Gaza began on October 7th, we saw people post on Twitter, on social media, kind of photos of Shireen, and just saying that, kind of wishing that she was around, that she was, alive to report, because she was such an incredible journalist and so needed in a time like this. Even the Lebanese journalist who was killed in a shelling in southern Lebanon by Israel, one of his last tweets was a photo of Shireen, and he just wrote Shireen with a heart. And then after he was killed, someone put up his photo and said, "I saw him with a heart."
Shireen, the latest news about the Israeli army bulldozing the memorial for her where she was killed?
Right. I mean, as we heard in headlines, Israel has repeatedly conducted very brutal raids on Jenin, on the Jenin refugee camp, which is the heart of militant Palestinian resistance in the West Bank. We've seen drone strikes on Jenin. Just a few days ago, a drone strike killed about 14 Palestinians in Jenin, one of the deadliest days in the West Bank since 2005. And we saw drone strikes just the other day as well, and raids on the hospital. And during one of these raids, they came in. The site where Shireen was shot by an Israeli sniper has become a memorial area. When I went there last year to report on her killing, there's photos of her everywhere. There's flowers. There's written pieces of tribute that are all hung up. The tree where she was killed under, you can still see the bullet holes. And it's a place where family and friends have sought some solace by visiting this area and remembering Shireen. And an Israeli bulldozer came in during one of these raids and completely destroyed this road and this area where this memorial was. And it doesn't seem... It seems to just be some kind of vindictive act, because there was no reason to destroy this road that leads to the entrance of the Jenin refugee camp. They've also, in an earlier raid, they destroyed this memorial, which was in the shape of a horse, which was kind of well known in Jenin in a main roundabout, and was built from the pieces of an ambulance that was blown up in an airstrike by Israel in 2002. And it was, they used the parts of the destroyed ambulance to kind of create this horse monument, which was a testament to Jenin's spirit of resistance. They also came in and kind of removed that. So there seems to be also an attack on symbols of resistance to Israel as well.
Well, Sharif, we're going to ask you to stay with us. We're going to switch gears. Sharif Abdelkaddous is a journalist who won a George Polk Award for the documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh for Al Jazeera's Fault Line series. After the break, Sharif will stay with us and we'll be joined by another guest to talk about his new documentary and all the latest developments around Cop City in Atlanta. Back in 20 seconds. Gods to Who by Andre 3000. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Atlanta, Georgia, where people from around the country joined in a week of action to stop the massive $90 million police training complex known as Cop City.
Now they're throwing tear gas into the crowd. They're throwing munitions. Yeah, that's tear gas.
On Monday, police attacked peaceful protesters with tear gas, pepper balls, flashbang grenades as over 400 marched toward the sacred Wilani Forest, the proposed site for Cop City. Participants included the parents of the environmental defender Manuel Esteban Terán, known as Tortuguita, who was fatally shot by Georgia state troopers during a raid on the Stop Cop City protest encampment in January.
Viva Tortuguita!
This comes as activists have been organizing for a citywide referendum on the project, which officials have tied up in court. Meanwhile, 61 people facing RICO or racketeering and domestic terrorism charges appeared in court this month as the state tries to characterize them as militant anarchists. Al Jazeera's Fault Lines recently covered all of this in their report, Now You're a Terrorist, Atlanta's Cop City Crackdown. Sharif Abdelkaddous spoke to environmental activist Sarah Wasilewski, one of the dozens charged with domestic terrorism for protesting Cop City. She described the January morning when Georgia law enforcement officers violently raided their protest encampment when state troopers shot and killed Tortuguita.
So I was sleeping in a hammock with my partner at the time. We woke up around like 8, maybe 7:45 in the morning.
Sarah Wasilewski had traveled from Pittsburgh to Atlanta and joined the protest for the weekend.
So we were just laying in bed talking, and then all of a sudden we heard and saw just like 15 or so police in full military, like, combat gear, like, with AR-15s just, like, coming through the woods directly at us. We were waiting to be put into a transport vehicle, and that's when I heard gunshots. I screamed when I heard it, and the police officer that, like, had me also responded, like, oh, shit. Like, they knew something bad happened.
While Sarah was being arrested, a team of officers killed Tortuguita in a barrage of gunfire.
Trifoil del Cadiz also spoke to indigenous forest defender Victor Puertas in a video call inside ICE's Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, where Puertas was held for over 7 months since his arrest. After being released on bond from DeKalb County Jail, Puertas was immediately taken into custody by ICE.
After weeks of negotiations with the detention center, we were able to speak to Victor by video call.
Hello.
Hi, Victor.
This is the first time he's spoken to the media since his arrest.
It feels like you're living a completely parallel life, you know? Like, your life stopped the moment that you got arrested, and now you have to make meaning of all this, you know?
And why is this movement so important to you, Victor?
I care about the land, I care about the people, I care about life, I care about the water, you know? I deeply care about those things. I grew up in that way. I was raised in that way.
So what do you think it does to a movement when the state labels it as a violent extremist organization and then charges its participants, like you, with domestic terrorism?
You know, you don't believe it first, you know? And then you realize, yeah, actually they're like passing these kind of laws, you know, to target certain groups of people. What's happening here in Georgia, in Atlanta, you know, it will have a repercussion all over the country.
For more, we're joined by two guests. Sharif Abdelkaddous is still with us, correspondent for this Al Jazeera Fault Lines report. And Kamau Franklin is joining us, founder of the organization Community Movement Builders, who's been part of the now two-year movement to stop Cop City. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Kamau, for the latest news of this week, over 60 people in court, many of them charged with domestic terrorism. Can you talk about the significance of what this means? As we heard this woman say, domestic terrorism and how it affects their whole lives.
Yes, thanks for having me. I mean, this issue goes to the heart of the militarization of the police and the criminalization of movements. What we're witnessing in Atlanta is a rebirth of the COINTELPRO movement to stamp out organizers and activists, to scare people into not speaking up and participating in movements. You have people who came to Atlanta who previously were not involved in any Cop City activity, but who happened to get rounded up by police. And the police looked at IDs, and if they had Georgia IDs, they let them go. If they had out-of-state IDs, they arrested them and charged them with domestic terrorism and later added on the charge of RICO. So you have people whose lives have been turned upside down. People who've been engaged in acts, some people who've been engaged in acts of simple civil disobedience by sitting in tents, by sitting in tree huts, who now, again, have domestic terrorism charges and RICO charges. And so, as you stated and as the documentary was saying, people's lives have been turned upside down because of the state's attempt to criminalize and brutalize activists and organizers who are working against police violence in our city.
Can you talk about the range of opposition? I mean, it's not just one group. It's people who are deeply concerned about police brutality. It's also religious leaders, indigenous leaders. Talk about the area where it's being built.
Yeah, one of the things about this movement has been, since the very beginning, it's been vast in its outreach. Everything from community organizers like myself, environmentalists, religious leaders, voting rights activists, yes, including anarchists, other people who are community members who've been engaged in this because they see two things happening. One is what we spoke about a couple of seconds ago, is the continued over-policing of black and brown communities that will be happening if Cop City is built. Two is the attack against movements, which is the very reason why this vast militarized facility is even being proposed. And then three is the environmental degradation of the Walani Forest, which is going to be ripped apart. Over 300 acres have been rented at $10 a year. 90 acres have already been cut down. This forest has been promised to a working-class adjacent black community for use of park space, for camping space, for trails, walking trails. All of those plans were ripped away as soon as they decided to put Cop City in. It's already caused environmental degradation in the neighborhood, and that will continue to happen as they go forth with their plans to try to build Cop City.
And what about the referendum? What's happened to it? An Atlanta-wide referendum so people could decide?
The city of Atlanta, along with the clerk's office, the mayor's office, the city council, have basically sat on this referendum. They've done nothing to move this forward, even though the organizers who did this, we collected over 116,000 signatures. The city council and the clerk's office could have started verifying these signatures as soon as we turned them in, but they decided to halt that process and to not do it. Further, the city council on its own could put a referendum on the ballot without even considering the signatures. And again, they have failed the city of Atlanta. They failed the people in Atlanta by allowing the people to decide. People, again, over 116,000 signatures of people saying that they want to vote on this. They want a voice on this. But the city has ignored it because it prefers to do backroom deals with corporations and with the Atlanta Police Foundation and with the police themselves and the state government. You have here a right-wing, white Republican state apparatus teaming up with a so-called liberal, moderate, Democratic black mayor apparatus. And the things that they agree upon most is how to protect cops and capitalism. And that's what's happening right now. And the referendum is being put on ice so that they can't be voted upon by the people in Atlanta.
Sharif, you spoke to Belkis Terán, the mother of the forest defender Manuel Esteban Paez Terán, known as Tortuguita, who was killed by Georgia police in January. Belkis traveled to Georgia from Panama, where she lives. I'm going to just play a short clip.
On officer.
I really don't believe anything what they say. I think they are lying. And there is nothing new. Everybody knows that police lie.
The county medical examiner didn't find any gunshot residue on Tortuguita's hands. And an independent autopsy suggests that Tortuguita was shot while seated with hands raised.
Manuel really was pacifist. He disliked the police very much, but not to kill anybody or to try to kill anybody. Manuel's life and message is to save the world, to save the green areas, to take care of the oceans.
Sharif, one of the first people we hear in your Fault Lines documentary, Now You're a Terrorist, is the mother of Tortuguita, Belkis Terán. Your overall take from covering issues all over the world, from going down to Atlanta and seeing what people were confronting here and now what they're being charged with. I mean, that's not to say Tortuguita, who was killed.
Right. Well, I think what's important to note about the movement to stop Cop City and defend the Atlanta forest is its resilience. You know, it's brought together, as you mentioned, abolitionists, environmentalists, indigenous rights leaders, religious leaders, a multifaceted resistance movement against this massive planned police training center. And the movement's lasted well over 2 years now. It's still going, despite this massive amount of state repression against it. And what we try and document in the documentary is that many of these there's a crackdown on even lawful political activities, and lawyers say this is unprecedented, that it's basically criminalizing political association. The indictment, where 61 people are charged in this wide-ranging racketeering case, the ACLU called the theory in the indictment shocking and unprecedented, and it basically relies on people's beliefs and community organizing as the basis for the sweeping criminal liability. And just finally, as we're talking internationally, too, there's protests by the Stop Cop City movement in support of Palestine as well, and against what's called the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, or GILE, where law enforcement officers from Atlanta, from across the state and the U.S., travel to Israel to receive training from Israeli police forces. Israel has long taken these strategies and techniques that are honed on the Palestinian body and then exported them abroad. And so we see these ties between Israel and police forces in Atlanta.
Sharif El-Quddous, he is the reporter on Now You're a Terrorist, the Fault Lines documentary. You can watch it online. And Kamau Franklin of Community Movement Builders.
Is that a normal part of your singing?
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
subliminal duet?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.